Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, who examines the extremely volatile situation in Iraq that Barack Obama will inherit when he becomes the nation's next commander-in-chief. Latifa Lyles of the National Organization for Women, who talks about the work her group will do under an Obama presidency to repair the many losses suffered during the 8 years of the Bush administration. And attorney Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who explains why he believes it's important to hold officials of the outgoing Bush administration accountable for war crimes when a new president takes office in January. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After a decade of calm, the insurgency on the island of Mindanao in the southern Philippines is heating up as talks over regional autonomy have fallen apart. In mid-August, rebels loyal to the Moro Islamic Liberation Front attacked a majority Christian village, burning houses, looting food supplies, and killing 13 villagers. According to the Washington Post, the Philippine Army has sent in 5,000 troops to the disputed region and attacked rebel bases with artillery and bombing attacks. Before the autonomy talks broke down in early August, Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo was prepared to grant Muslims local control over some sectors of Mindanao, a proposal backed by the Bush administration. In 2005, the Muslim rebels helped the American Army expel the extremist group Abu Sayyaf from Mindanao, which has ties to Al-Qaeda. As a deal appeared near on autonomy, the Supreme Court of the Philippines questioned the legality of the arrangement granting new powers to the Muslim population. Muslims have lived in Mindanao for centuries and successfully resisted Spanish colonialists who attempted to force their conversion to Catholicism. Sergeant Juan Jimenez returned from his tour of duty in Baghdad a hero with two Purple Hearts and shrapnel in his right arm. What Jimenez did not expect was to have to fight the Department of Veterans Affairs to prove that he was injured in battle and deserved veterans benefits. In Iraq, Jimenez was injured by two separate roadside bombs that left him with a brain injury and other physical ailments, including seizures, memory loss, nightmares, ringing in the ears, flashbacks, and acid reflux disease. Yet the VA denied his claim, stating his health problems were caused by drinking too much caffeine. According to The Nation magazine, Jimenez joined other veterans in a 2007 class action lawsuit against the VA, filed by Veterans for Common Sense. The suit sought a complete overhaul of the VA and how it treats returning veterans. The case went to trial in San Francisco last April. Federal Judge Samuel Conte, in his July ruling, said that although the VA's current performance was troubling, his court did not have the power to reorganize the VA. The ruling angered Jimenez. "I don't understand it," he said. "If he recognizes the problem, he should do something about it." Veterans for Common Sense has appealed. Their case is pending before the Ninth Circuit. In the meantime, the group's members have been working to raise awareness of the case, reaching out to other veterans groups and to members of Congress. After the November 4th election, the Newhouse News Service will shut down its Washington, D.C. bureau as regional newspapers and chains cut back their coverage of Congress and federal agencies. Newhouse owns 26 daily newspapers, like the Newark Star-Ledger and the Cleveland Plain Dealer. In addition, the San Diego Union-Tribune, which is up for sale, is also closing its Pulitzer-winning Washington News Bureau on November 30th. In the last 2 years, papers in mid-sized cities like Pittsburgh, Hartford, Des Moines, and Salt Lake City have reduced its staff in the nation's capital. According to the American Prospect, the impact of the cuts will mean fewer journalists covering Congress and less investigative reporting of critical federal agencies. News bureaus like McClatchy, which remain skeptical of the buildup for the war in Iraq, have been a reliable alternative to the conventional wisdom found in the Washington Post and the New York Times. Readers will now find alternatives in independent media organizations stepping in to fill the vacuum, like Mother Jones Magazine, which recently opened a sizable Washington bureau under the leadership of former Nation writer David Korn. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
A Although the war in Iraq and the public's disillusionment with that conflict have largely been overshadowed during the election campaign by the urgency of the U.S. financial collapse, the next president will be faced with many difficult choices when he takes office in January. President-elect Barack Obama anchored his presidential campaign on his early opposition to the war and has pledged to withdraw U.S. troops on a timetable by mid-2010. But the next occupant of the White House may find it difficult to honor their campaign pledges in a still very unstable Iraq, where rival militia and religious groups have yet to sort out their differences over basic governance issues and the allocation of billions of dollars in revenue from vast oil reserves. Once the most advanced Middle Eastern nation, Iraq today stands as a shattered state, devastated by years of an economic embargo, followed by the U.S. invasion and five-year occupation. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, who examines the extremely volatile situation in Iraq that Barack Obama will inherit when he becomes the nation's next commander-in-chief.
The political challenges in Iraq remain quite similar to what they were at the beginning of this year. There is a marked decline in violence, yes, certainly that targeting U.S. forces and to a lesser extent that targeting Iraqis, although Iraqis are still dying in alarmingly high numbers, and one certainly cannot characterize the security situation in Iraq as stable at all. But the political problems remain. We have the Maliki government, which has essentially the same narrow sectarian base that it did before the surge and all of this started. The Maliki government remains very resistant to the idea of integrating the so-called Sons of Iraq, the former Sunni Arab insurgents who have been on the U.S. payroll for the better part of a year and a half, into the Iraqi security forces. There's still an immense level of distrust between the former Sunni Arab insurgents and Sunni Arabs more generally, and what they see as a sectarian and pro-Iranian government of Nouri al-Maliki. And that distrust shows no signs of fading. There has been no progress to speak of on the political issues of genuine national reconciliation, such as revising the Iraqi constitution that was passed in 2005, which at one point was a major goal of the U.S. There has been no meaningful progress on that. Another outstanding question is the status of the Sadrist movement, those anti-occupation Shiites who are loyal to the cleric Muqtada Sadr and have a very ambiguous, often hostile relationship with the government of Nouri al-Maliki as well. They also took the decision to lay down their arms several months ago, which has contributed greatly to the decline in violence in Iraq, but they are also chafing under the new conditions and certainly chafing at the idea that there would be an indefinite extension of the U.S. occupation, which they very much oppose. And so it remains to be seen what sort of attitude they will take and whether they might take up arms again, either against the U.S. or against the Iraqi government or both. So the questions going forward are more numerous than the answers, I think.
Taking office, what unique challenges will President Barack Obama face, given the difficulties you just laid out and his relatively shorter time horizon for exiting Iraq than his opponent John McCain?
Well, I tend to doubt that Obama will in fact hew to the pledge that he has made to withdraw all forces in 16 months. I think he's already said in this past summer that he would refine his stance on Iraq depending on conditions on the ground, and I think it's most likely that the first few months of his presidency would be devoted to some kind of study of the situation in Iraq to assess what those conditions are, and I think it's likely that he'll come up with a stance not dissimilar from that of the Bush administration, which is that U.S. withdrawal needs to be conditions-based. Of course, that will be couched in a much firmer commitment to getting out as soon as possible, and there will likely be some limited drawdowns of troops, if nothing else, to ship them off to Afghanistan, where candidate Obama has promised, as has candidate McCain, an escalated U.S. military effort. But I don't think that will translate into a rapid U.S. withdrawal, regardless of the status of the agreement between the U.S. and Iraq.
Chris Tenzing, looking at the situation in Afghanistan, most observers agree that there's a very steeply deteriorating situation going on there. And Barack Obama particularly has said that he would divert many more U.S. troops into that fight. If you were advising the new president what course of action to follow in Afghanistan, what would your advice be?
My advice would be similar to that in Iraq, which is to disengage militarily and to re-engage politically and with the promise of long-term U.S. financial investment in the country. What's needed in Afghanistan in the long run is to build roads, to encourage all kinds of self-sustaining economic development that can hold out the hope of, in the long run, pulling that country out of its war economy and putting it onto a more peaceful a pathway towards some kind of economic self-sufficiency. That, I do not think, can be achieved through military means. I think, as British officials have said and as Defense Secretary Robert Gates himself has hinted, the way forward politically in Afghanistan ultimately is going to be for the U.S. to make a deal of some kind with the Taliban to bring some kind of truce and political stability to the country and allow U.S. troops to leave in an orderly fashion without being shot at as they leave. I think the alternative is that the U.S. military effort in Afghanistan will end in ignominy sooner rather than later.
That was Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report. Contact them by calling area code 202-223-3677 or visit their website at merip.org. The National Organization for Women, or NOW, founded in 1966, is one of the oldest and largest multi-issue women's organizations in the U.S. Over the decades, it has worked on six core issues: reproductive rights, including abortion, birth control, and the rights of pregnant women, the fight against racism, gay and lesbian rights, violence against women, constitutional equality through the Equal Rights Amendment, and economic justice for women. In endorsing Barack Obama in this year's presidential election, NOW cited, among other issues, the Democratic candidate's opposition to George Bush's extreme right-wing nominees to the Supreme Court, who have consistently ruled against women's rights. As NOW and many other groups advocating a woman's right to choose have observed, the composition of the Supreme Court is critical in deciding the future of the landmark Roe v. Wade decision, which legalized abortion rights in 1973. The next president will likely have the opportunity to nominate one or more Supreme Court justices, which will change the balance of the court and influence its future decisions on abortion and other questions of individual liberty. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with NOW Vice President Latifa Lyles about the work her group will do under an Obama presidency to repair the many losses suffered during the 8 years of the Bush administration.
With an Obama-Biden victory, we know that we can hopefully, for once, put down our guard and really get to the table to start to talk about repairing some of the damage that has been done over the past 8 years, including worldwide restrictions on reproductive health care services that we fund through our government, whether it's about the, you know, fixing the equal pay law in Congress that dramatically damaged how women have the right to sue if they're discriminated against in their pay over the past year in the Supreme Court, talking about the protections that we are losing with the hostility to Roe v. Wade, including appointing a Supreme Court replacement for someone who, you know, we have a couple of Supreme Court justices currently who could very well retire in the next few years. We know that Barack Obama will be possibly in the position to appoint a new Supreme Court justice, and working with him to, you know, cover the issues that are important to us and to make sure that while there's no litmus test, that there's certainly no appointments that are going to be hostile to women. And we're confident that Barack Obama is not going to appoint a Supreme Court justice to the Supreme Court who is hostile to women. We've talked about this. He's talked about it as part of their platform. Whether you're talking about affirmative action or equal pay, these are both issues that have been incorporated into their talking points in a way, frankly, that no candidate has done in years.
But Obama's opposed to gay marriage.
Yeah, he stated that, you know, he believes marriage in that sense is between a man and a woman, but what he has also said is that he believes that to the fullest extent that lesbian and gay couples should be afforded the same benefits that you would be getting in a civil union. So that includes from financial perspective, from health perspective, the McCain and Palin camp had never maintained that. And so from an ideological perspective, yeah, they have said marriage is between a man and a woman, but what we know, which is a big part of this fight, is the extension of benefits with which Barack Obama and Joe Biden support.
Biden has been touted as a key sponsor of the Violence Against Women Act, so I guess you must feel you'd get support on that issue from the new administration.
You know, Joe Biden has for years been a staunch supporter and was very, very involved in the first passage of the Violence Against Women Act, which was one of our great accomplishments in the women's movement, and for years we have fought and fought to expand it. We have fought to keep funding, and we know that having Biden as a vice president, we can, again, let our guard down a bit, and knowing we have a champion there who is determined to work and fight to end violence against women, that is one issue where we know we have a very strong ally, and all the increased funding and expansion of the programs that we've been struggling for and not getting for years hopefully will come to reality.
Latifa Lyles, I want to talk about constitutional equality for women. Did NOW ask the candidates to fill out a questionnaire on your top issues? Or in any other way, do you know what Obama's position is? Like if the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, were to be reintroduced, what he would say about that?
No, we didn't really do that. Currently, there's a lot of different people who think that the way we get constitutional equality is and then the older strategy, and we definitely have Congress people who, Kennedy and Carolyn Maloney, for example, who continue to keep it and bring it up and to reintroduce it. So we definitely have some allies. So we haven't made this a campaign issue, though I don't anticipate that Barack Obama and Joe Biden would not be supportive of our efforts to include women in the Constitution.
What about pay equality for women? He's spoken in support of Lilly Ledbetter, right? The woman who sued after she realized she was getting paid so much less than her male counterparts?
Absolutely. One of the things that we're overwhelmed about is he's talked about Lilly Ledbetter. He talks about the Supreme Court and the impact this election is going to make on the balance of the Supreme Court. He's talked about equal pay for women, and he has even had Lilly Ledbetter right by his side when addressing crowds, and we are extremely excited that his campaign actually paid for ads that actually feature Lilly talking about her story.
I don't think NOW is that well known for having the struggle against racism as one of its pillars, but just talk a little about how an Obama presidency would affect that struggle.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of issues of race and discrimination have come up as a result of voters and their positions around this election, but from a policy perspective, we definitely talk about strengthening the various laws that prevent discrimination in the workplace across the board, whether it's women or people of color, pay disparities based on race and sex, and educational opportunities based on race and sex. And we know that we have seen a lot of rollbacks in affirmative action or even a lot of attempts at the state level to essentially gut the affirmative action laws that exist. And we know that Barack Obama and Joe Biden are on the same page we are when it comes to the reasons why we need to affirm, I suppose, and to protect affirmative action and to hopefully undo some of the damage that's been done. The National Organization for Women, feminists all over the country, I mean, we really are excited at the prospect of having someone in the White House, Obama and Biden, who we can work with. It's not even just the idea of these two people are on our issues, but we are really hopeful at the dialogue being opened.
That was Latifa Lyles, Vice President of the National Organization for Women. Contact NOW at area code 202-628-8669. Or visit their website at now.org. In his new book, The Trial of Donald Rumsfeld, attorney Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights makes the case that the former defense secretary, along with 14 other government and military officials, including President Bush and Vice President Cheney, as unindicted co-conspirators, should be charged with torture and war crimes. Evidence that the Bush administration has violated both U.S. and international law is found in the testimony of detainees held at the infamous Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo prisons. Statements of American whistleblowers who witnessed the torture and abuse of prisoners firsthand, including waterboarding and stress positions, stands as a powerful indictment of President Bush's post-9/11 policies that guided his war on terror. As the next president takes office in January, human rights activists and many ordinary citizens will be working hard to restore both America's reputation and constitutional protections that have been systematically dismantled by the Bush administration over the past 8 years. Ending torture, rendition, illegal detention, and domestic spying are among a long list of issues that will be a top priority for groups working to change the direction of the country under the new administration. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with the Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Michael Ratner about why he believes it's important to hold officials of the outgoing Bush administration accountable for war crimes when Barack Obama takes power in January.
There's two U.S. federal statutes, the war crime statute and the anti-torture statute, that clearly make crimes out of what this administration has done with regard to the torture program. The evidence in this book, the evidence from other sources, it's very clear that high administration officials approved it, instigated the program, and were deeply involved in carrying it out. The case is pretty clear for appointment of a special prosecutor or a prosecutor doing it. What you get, though, on even the people who are sympathetic on this issue to the anti-torture position is that, well, it's unrealistic. We can't expect the prosecution in the United States. Why should we fight for something like that? It's either candidate wins, it's not going to happen, and therefore we're much better fighting to try and stop torture in the future and to try and get some of these memos withdrawn, etc. And my position is quite different than that. My position is that as long as it's allowed that the United States or any country could begin to torture people after a terrorist attack, and unless people are held accountable for that, and I mean accountable in criminal prosecutions, that the next attack, they'll do it again. And some other country in the world is going to be able to point to the United States and say, you did it, we can do it. And the next time our soldier is going to be captured and gets tortured, someone's going to say, well, we can do it, you did it. So there's a real need for accountability. And there's a real need, I think, for people not to take really a position that says the best we're going to get is, therefore don't ask for prosecution. If you don't ask for prosecution, you're clearly never going to get it. If you demand it, if you ask for it, if you push it, you may see it happen. You may not see it happen in 1 year. You may not see it happen in 2 years. But like it took a number of years to bring some of these people to justice, whether it's Pinochet, which took 35 years, or this guy in Chicago, the police chief torturer, 10 years, 20 years, it's going to happen. But I certainly don't think people ought to give up on it.
Michael, you and the Center for Constitutional Rights have been engaged on a whole range of civil liberties and human rights violations in this Bush administration. And as you look at the next president taking office, what would be some of your top priorities in the job of restoring U.S. Credibility and legitimacy around the world in observation of human rights?
If I had one change to make, it would be to abide by the United Nations Charter. It essentially says there's only two circumstances you can go to war in. One is in genuine self-defense, and the other is when you get approval of the UN Security Council. And that's it. I don't want to see any more wars than that. So that's on the broad level. On the level that we've been working on the fundamental human rights, which is what I call the worldwide detention and torture program, that's fairly straightforward. And the next president could, and we have a campaign at the center called the First 100 Days, could within the first 100 days, without even going to Congress, really rid us of some of the worst of the excesses of the Bush administration human rights violations. One would be to abolish end Guantanamo and offshore detention facilities. End Guantanamo, that would be just a given, and they could do it by executive order. They could close it down. They could. We have a plan for what you could do with all the people there. Most of them could be returned to their home countries. Close down all the secret sites in the world. Whether they're maybe not be in Poland anymore, but now they're maybe in North Africa or Thailand or Diego Garcia or wherever they are. There's no place in this world for secret detention facilities. Offshore penal colonies, secret detention facilities, places in in Afghanistan that are similar to those. What those are first, people are unaccountable in those. You don't know who they are, you don't know what prisoners they have. And when they have secret detention, you automatically, really automatically get torture. The reason for secret detention really, really is torture. So the second thing that you would have to ask any administration to do is have a full ban on torture. Not the ban that's in the current law now, which is that the army can't use, the military can't use torture anymore, but include the CIA and include it to protect any person in U.S. custody anywhere in the world. That's number two, could be done by executive order. Number three, end what I call the what's called the extraordinary rendition program, the idea that you can pick up people anywhere in the world and send them to another country to be tortured, or it's likely they'll be tortured. That, again, could be done by executive order. That practice started, unfortunately, with Clinton. It's continued into the Bush administration, but it should be banned altogether. Those are three key things. The fourth one would be get rid of these kangaroo court military commission trials. That's just, I mean, embarrassment is not a strong enough word. Those are actually violations of Geneva Conventions. Those are irregular systems of justice. They're not justice at all. They're not really courts. Try people, if they're in civilians, try them in our federal courts. If they're not, if they're in military, try them in uniform, and then courts marshals, get rid of them. So those four key things, end detention, end torture, end rendition, and end military commissions, are absolutely crucial in the next administration.
Well, thank you, Michael, again. And I'd be curious to see who Bush is going to be pardoning as he exits the Oval Office.
That's a really important topic, actually, which we didn't cover. But I think there's a fair chance that Bush will issue what's called a blanket pardon. He may not even name people, Scott, so we may not know. But he will say something like, anybody involved in allegedly the violations of the Geneva Conventions or in violations of the anti-torture statute worked for this administration between such and such years is hereby pardoned. And it'll include himself.
Does that hold up?
You know, the pardoning power is very, very broad. I'm not saying we would litigate it, but it's a very difficult issue.
That was Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and author of the book, The Trial of Donald Rumsfeld, A Prosecution by Book. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at ccrjustice.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.